Thanks, Mark. The Westminster Confession of Faith talks about God this way. There is but one only living and true God, who is infinite in being and perfection, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions, immutable, immense, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, most wise, most holy, most free, most absolute, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutable and most righteous will for his own glory. God has all life, glory, goodness, blessedness in and of himself, and is alone in and unto himself all-sufficient, not standing in need of any creature which he has made, not deriving any glory from them, but only manifesting his own glory in, by, unto, and upon them. He is the alone fountain of all being, of whom, through whom, and to whom are all things. What sort of God does that represent to you? When you hear those words, what sort of God comes into your mind? It might be a God that seems very unrelatable, that seems serenely unmoved and untouched by everything that happens in the world. It might seem like a God who's more like an inert object than a person. If that's how you feel when you hear those words, then you're not alone. Most of the history of 20th century theology is people feeling that way. Is people looking at that confession of God. And by the way, that's not a particularly Protestant confession of God. That confession could have applied equally to Eastern Orthodoxy, to Catholicism, to all of the Christian church, up to the modern period. But in the modern period, suddenly that way of thinking and talking about God felt remote. It felt like someone that couldn't be in a loving relationship with us. And so in the 20th century, we began modifying or rejecting those ways of speaking about God. He said, if God is immutable, if he doesn't change, then he couldn't really be in relationship with us. If God is infinite, then he would swallow up the world and he would leave no space for us to be genuine independent agents. If God was incomprehensible, then how could we be in a knowing, loving, caring, intimate relationship with him? And most of all, if God is consumed with his own glory, then how could he be a God of love and self-sacrifice? So what was the solution? I'll give you a hint where this is going now. The solution was to domesticate God. So the solution was to say, if God's going to really relate to us and love for us and care for us, then he must be a little bit more like us than claims like the Westminster Confession leads us to think. He must be a bit more human, a bit more personal, if he's really going to be relatable. And this is not a liberal movement, actually. This is something which you see in academic theology, sometimes associated with liberalism, and this is something you see just as much or even more so in evangelical conservative approaches to God. Why did this happen? Interestingly, it doesn't happen with people that are necessarily obsessed with the modern world. Oftentimes it happens with people that say, we want to think about God purely as the Bible tells us to do. But for some reason, our forefathers in the faith, up to the 20th century, when they read the Bible, they read about a very different God. And suddenly in the 20th century, when we read the Bible, we say the God presented in the Bible cannot be that God of the Westminster Confession. Why? Why this radical change amongst people that are both liberal and conservative? Amongst people that are in the academy, or that are in the pews? Well, I don't know, but I'll take a guess. One of the most influential texts in the 20th century for theology is Jürgen Moltmann's Crucified God. And Jürgen Moltmann begins that book in the preface of the introduction talking about coming back, thinking about God after the world wars. And he talks about how for what he called the shattered and broken survivors of my generation, who were returning from the camps and the hospitals to the church and to the theological lecture room, the God that is spoken of in those terms, who is unchanging, who is infinite, could not be a God that we could speak about anymore. Because in light of the suffering that they had encountered, they thought we need to think about God in a new way, in a way that is more relational, more personal, and that is more like us. Now, this is a really compelling vision. I think we need to recognize that. And I won't give it all the justice it deserves this morning, to be fair. And there's things about it that are very right, that we should absolutely recognize. But what Moltmann saw correctly, and what many like him saw correctly, and which sometimes evangelicals that take seriously this feeling that they have that we need to speak about God who is with us and who is personal and who relates to us, all good things. What they haven't taken as seriously as someone like Moltmann does is that if you want to get rid of the God described in the Westminster Confession, if you want to get rid of a God that is unchanging and that is perfect and that is infinite, you can't just change the way you think about the cross. And you can't just change the way you think about the way God relates to people in the Old Testament. You have to reconstruct the way you think about God from the ground up. And that's what someone like Moltmann did. Moltmann said that God couldn't be fully loving without creating the world. God could only be really, fully, truly, and completely loving if he had someone outside of himself to love. So Moltmann thought about creation as an act of, in a sense, suffering. God suffered like a mother giving birth. He opened up space, he retracted, he pulled back, he limited himself so that he could really relate to the world in a personal way. He thought if we're going to have a God that is relevant, and this is the first chapter of the Crucified God, is the crisis of relevancy. This is what he was concerned about. How is the church, how is the gospel going to be relevant in a modern world? He said if we're going to do that, we need to totally rethink God from the ground up. Now, I think in our churches today, we tend to either follow this Moltmannian line about making God relevant or take the equal opposite mirror image approach. And as Mark was talking about, I think both of those extremes are dead ends. Sorry, one of the things about writing this sermon in the middle of the night last night is that I'm going to be very unnuanced in everything that I said. I hope I would have been much more nuanced if it wasn't the fact that I was, you know, slamming away at my computer in the middle of the night. Also, I really like to go to bed early. 9:15 is my bedtime. So getting a call at 9:30 was like, that was brutal. But Moltmann said we need to make God relevant. So what's the opposite of making God relevant? It's fundamentalism. It's a fundamentalism which says we need to be combative, we need to be antagonistic, we need to hide from the world, and we need to hide from modern science, from the deliverances of history. We need to view the world as something that is always going to drag us away from the truth. So the church is tempted with that. The church is tempted with turning to fundamentalism. But the church is also tempted, and I will say I myself am far more tempted, by this vision of relevancy. And I think relevancy gets things precisely the wrong way around. The American theologian Stephen Long says that the church has no problem with relevancy. Its problem is redundancy. And if you think the problem is relevancy, then you will give precisely the wrong solution. Because the problem, if our problem is being relevant, then we need to convince the world that whatever problems you have, however you construct your world, however you construct your life, we want to beg you, plead with you, and convince you that we can fit into that. But what if the problem is redundancy? What is the problem? What if the problem is that everything that the church used to do, now someone else can do better? The church used to provide a moral conscience to the state. Now we have special interest groups. The church used to provide consolation in the midst of the struggles of life. Now we have therapists. The church used to provide a community for people that were isolated. Now we have social media. That's a terrifying thought. Theology used to be a way to seek for truth. Now we have science. We have the sciences, and we have anthropology. If this diagnosis is correct, then the more we try to convince the world that we have something that is just like what they want, the more irrelevant we become. Because the problem is that everything the gospel has to offer seems redundant. Now, the great person who exposed this, the three great critics of Christianity in the modern world are Freud, Nietzsche, and Feuerbach. Feuerbach is the one that we probably know the least about. If in academic circles, he's very popular. He's less popular in the church. If you want to struggle with your faith, read The Essence of Christianity by Feuerbach. It's an incredibly challenging book. And in that book, his main charge against Christianity is that Christianity is just wish fulfillment. It's the projecting of our human nature and pretending that there was some being in the sky, some superhuman being in the sky. And it's us looking at ourselves and taking who we wish we were, that we wish we were stronger, we wish we were better, we wish that things couldn't hurt us and harm us, and pretending that such a superhuman being existed in the sky to protect us. For Feuerbach, that's what all religion is. And so when you read him, he actually sounds a lot like a theologian. He will talk for pages and pages and pages about God. Because for him, when we're talking about God, we're really just talking about how do we be better people? How do we be a better version of our own humanity? And the truth is, that's actually how everyone views religion today. Let me tell you, you might be not trying with me. Let me explain to you what I mean. When you go to your friends and neighbors and you share the gospel, what is the reaction that you get? I think we often think we're going to get antagonism. We often think they will be angry and they will want to fight with us and they will want to debate us and they're all just little mini Richard Dawkins ready to do battle. But they're not. What is the normal reaction? If it works for you, great. Right? If it works for you, great. Why? Because religion is just one more form of self-actualization. It's just one more way to be the sort of person that you want to be a complete, whole human person. And if that's what works for you, great. But it doesn't, I don't need it. What's the problem? It's redundant. It's not that it's irrelevant. Sure, if I needed it, it would be totally relevant, but I don't need it. I have other ways of being a full, complete, whole, happy person. Feuerbach has encompassed completely the way we think about religion. And it's the way we think about God, too. When we think, if God is going to really relate to us, if he's really going to love us, if he's really going to be personal, we need to make him more like us. We're making him redundant. We're making him the big therapist in the sky. And when we have no other hope, when we have no other need, then great, we can go to him and he'll offer peace, he'll offer consolation, but when we're feeling a bit better, or when we get with a really good focus group, or we find another source of help, we won't need him anymore. This is the God that our society thinks we believe in. And sadly, I think for many of us, it is the God we believe in. So is there another route forward? Is there a God who isn't only relevant, but who also is non-redundant? I think the God we read about in Isaiah 40 is a brilliant vision of this. Isaiah 40 is the turning point. Isaiah 39 and 40 are the turning point of the book of Isaiah. There's been this fear. Isaiah's been crying out to God because he's afraid that the Assyrians are going to come conquer Judea. And God actually miraculously rescues Judea. And Isaiah is delighted. And then in 39 and 40, God says, by the way, the Babylonians are coming. And I'm not going to rescue you this time. And so Isaiah 40 begins with this word, comfort, comfort. Because the question now is actually the question that we all find ourselves crying out. And it's the question that Moltmann and his generation were crying out after World War II. Isaiah 40, verse 27, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. This is the question of modern persons, I agree. The question is, God, do you care? Do I matter to you? Where are you in the midst of life suffering and its inexplicable sorrow? And what is the answer Isaiah gives? It's an interesting pastoral response. The answer is the doctrine of God. I'm going to just read a couple lines. I'm sorry, I'm not going to go systematically through the passage. Isaiah 40:14, whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? Who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? What is that saying? It's saying that God's not the smartest thing around. It's saying that God doesn't have the biggest brain. It's saying that it's metaphysically impossible for God to learn anything. It's saying that God's knowledge is of such an order that it is impossible for it to grow. That God's not just the smartest thing in the room, that God has a knowledge which is incomparable to any other sort of knowledge. Isaiah 40:22-23 says, he sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings pieces, princes to naught, and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. This God is so powerful that if you add up all of the power in the world and compare it to God, all of the power in the world equals zero. This is supposed to be baffling. This is supposed to be mind-blowing. God is not the smartest, the strongest lad in the gym. God is of such an order of power that all of the power in the world is not even comparable to the sort of potency he possesses. The nations are like a drop in the bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Before him, all nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. First God's knowledge, then God's power, then his existence, his being. God's very existence is on such an order of being that all of the universe cannot be put on a scale next to him. A great Dominican theologian said that the universe plus God doesn't equal two. God is of such an order that you can't even compare his existence to the entire universe. And this is how the psalm ends. To whom will you, or this is how Isaiah, this is the main theme of Isaiah 40. To whom then will you compare me? And he immediately says, anything you would compare me with would make me an idol. He starts talking about idolatry. If you think that I can even be compared to anything in the world, you're going to fall into idolatry. Let me tell you how he's telling us to conceive God. This is a great, this is a mental exercise from a Puritan, okay? And he said, if you want to conceive God, do this. So we're going to go through a mental exercise, and we're going to conceive God this morning, okay? You guys ready for this? Very skeptical. Okay, he says, right now, you can close your eyes, you can sort of make a Buddhist om if you want, do whatever you want. He says, think of the most excellent being you can conceive. Remove anything imperfect from your conception. Think of him as the most pure spirit imaginable. Now think of him as if he is confined to no space. Think of him as if he knows everything to know without any processes of reasoning. He knows it all immediately, in a moment. Think of him as light. Pure, spotless light with no darkness. Think of every perfection in the maximal degree inhering in him. Maximal wisdom, maximal goodness, maximal power. Maximally above all the greatest creatures. Have you done it? Have you risen in your mind to the greatest conceivable thing? Now the final stage is you must say this. Say, this is not God. God is more than this. God is incomprehensibly above whatsoever I can think or conceive or say. God is incomparable. By the way, this exercise is a radically pre-modern approach. In the most, I was just reading a book yesterday randomly, so it's coincidental, said the most influential philosophers of religion. I'm not going to say who they are because I don't want to name names. One of them, who is British, in his most influential book, has an exercise exactly like this. It goes through the same stages, almost in a more modern key. It says, remove all of these imperfections. Think of God as the most perfect being imaginable. But you want to know how it ends? It says, now you have conceived an omnipresent, omnipotent spirit. This is God. That's how it ends. That is the domestication of God. That is the creating of God in our own image. Now, we've talked about this God that is totally transcendent, totally above us, and so now does it just seem like, actually, the critique of the Westminster Confession was right? This God is so incomprehensible that our highest thoughts can't even reach to him. No. Because it's all of that vision of God which gets you to the end of Isaiah 40. Which then says, to whom then will you compare me that I should be like him, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. He's saying, look at the stars. Who created all of these? He who brings out the starry hosts one by one and calls forth each by name. Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord? He's forgotten me. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding none can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. The answer to this question, this very modern question of have you forgotten me, for the author of Isaiah is look at the heavens, look at the stars. If the incomprehensible being that made those is for you, then he has a power which cannot be hindered. He has a knowledge which means you're never beyond what he can see. You need not fear anything, because this God is with you and for you. And Isaiah 40, most of all, is also about the coming of this God to Israel. The coming of this God to Israel to rescue and redeem his people. And when Matthew, in his gospel, sees the coming of Jesus, and he sees John the Baptist, who is preparing the way for this Jesus, his mind recalls the God of Isaiah 40. He says, this is who John the Baptist is preparing the way for. This is whose path he is making straight. This is that incomprehensible, infinite God taking on flesh, returning to his people, and coming with unimaginable immediacy to dwell alongside them. Today I'm doing a terrible, terrible task, which is replacing Ivor Davidson, which there is no replacing Ivor Davidson. Ivor Davidson is one of my theological heroes. So is Grant, but that's kind of weird to say now. Ivor Davidson, this is the simplest thing in the world, but I've never forgotten it. When I was sitting in an early church history class with him, he says, if you want to know what the early church councils were all about, they were all a debate about how close could God come. How close can God come to us? And the way that they usually, the most heresies didn't actually minimize that by saying Jesus didn't come really close. They actually minimized it by saying he's not really the God of Isaiah 40. They said, well, if he could come this close, then he must not really be that God. He must be a sort of lesser God, a sort of lesser deity, that there's another God above. What Isaiah 40 is all about is a God that is incomprehensible and incomparable and yet can come unimaginably, intimately close in Jesus Christ. That this God that is made the stars was born in a dirty stable. That he was a helpless baby. That he suffers betrayal, abandonment, and utter and complete forsakenness. That he dies covered in mire and blood. That he enters the darkness of Calvary. That he lies in the grave for 3 days. This is a God who isn't only relevant, but who is surpassingly non-redundant. And the pastoral implication is this. And I'm just going to end making a couple suggestions here, which then hopefully will fill out as the day goes on. If this vision of God is true, then it is impossible, it is literally metaphysically impossible, for God to get anything from creation. It's impossible. Everything God does, every single thing God does towards the world is gift. And that's not because you have a weak, liberal, nice, sort of grandpa-in-the-sky vision of God. It's because you have a classic account of God that the whole church affirmed. You have an account of God that is so transcendent, so perfect, so full in himself that everything he does in the world is gift. That's actually what the Westminster Confession said, by the way. Let me read this line again. He himself, all-sufficient, not standing in need of any creatures which he has made, not deriving any glory from them, but only manifesting his own glory in, by, and unto them. What is he saying? Everything God does, his glory is not to the exclusion of humans. It's not putting down creatures. It's giving. Because he's already so full, the only way he could be more full is just by giving and giving and giving and giving, by pure generosity with no return. Now that has profound pastoral implications. And that's something that I think you've been thinking about this week, you've been thinking about with Grant, that if that is true, we have to rethink how we think about the law. God's law. We don't need to be afraid to talk about God's law. We can proclaim God's law, because the law can't be for God to get something from us. It's another way of him giving to us. We can proclaim God's glory, because God being more and more and more glory isn't him taking something from creatures. It's only him giving more and more and more. We can talk about God's justice, because God's justice isn't some debt or lack in his being that is unfulfilled. It's another way that he wills that creatures be all they were created and meant to be. And finally, we can, with full reformational conviction that insists on grace alone, faith alone, imputation, all of those things, talk a lot about the need for us to do things. We don't need to be afraid to talk about that. Because we have this weird view sometimes that justification, that salvation is something that God does for us, and then sanctification is something that we do to pay him back. Or that the Christian life is something that is then required to fulfill a need in God. That actually only works on a very modern, small view of God. It's actually impossible on a classical doctrine of God, that God could ever ask you to do something so that he could get something from you. This God is more loving, more good, more generous than anything we could ever imagine or conceive. So let's not domesticate him. Let me close this in prayer.
I just want to applaud. Finished at what time this morning?
10. No, wait. Yeah, 10. I left home at 10. But some of that I've given before.
Yeah.
You've heard some of that.
Let me ask you a quick question just to add to that last pastoral implication. Implications of not only does God, can we not give God anything, but do you want to talk briefly about the implications? Sometimes we think of God as being a bit capricious, going off on a huff if we don't get things right.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, when we talk about things like divine anger, divine wrath, divine justice, all of those things, that can only be a way of God willing that creatures flourish. Now, of course, that doesn't look like what we would think a kind, loving person would do. Of course, that doesn't look at all like we would expect it. But that can still only be, that can't be God suddenly getting mad, suddenly realizing, why? Because what would it mean to suddenly get mad? To be overcome with anger? It's to be surprised. It's for something to come upon you you weren't expecting. And if God is this sort of God, all-knowing, outside of time, then of course that's not possible. So even God's justice and wrath, which we need to talk about as Scripture does, our way of him willing that creatures flourish.
That was a very good answer, even if he wasn't listening.
Right, let's see any questions or thoughts. I mean, we're touching on some deep stuff, but as Jared is teasing out of us, we have profound practical pastoral implications. Tom, let's see if you can.
Thanks very much, Jared. Could you then speak for a moment about what it means to glorify God? Because I think for many evangelicals, that sin that we do to God, and if you speak from what actually means then.
Yeah. Just to be clear again, yeah, I'm sorry if there's bits of that that were unnuanced, which might be the case. Also, yeah, even someone like Moltmann I've learned a lot from. To glorify God is to render him what is due to him, in the sense of we are a creature. We were made to honor God, to respect him as our creator, as our redeemer, as our restorer, all those things. So yeah, it is absolutely Godward directed. And it just doesn't give God something that he wouldn't have had otherwise, right? And so it is directed towards God, but it is also then, well, why would God want us to glorify him? Why would he want us to? Well, because it's fitting, absolutely, but even more so because that's how we are fulfilled as creatures. That, as you know, the famous Irenaeus quote is, the glory of God is a fully alive man, or a man completely alive. He just means what it means to be a human is to be someone that is subsumed fully in enjoying God's glory. Yeah.
Let me follow on that. If leadership in the body of Christ is the model of God's character, its implications for how we might lead.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you've thought a lot more about this than I have, Mark. But of course, it's servant leadership. Of course, it's an act of unending generosity, which is never to take something from someone else, but to give. Again, that doesn't mean that there's no such thing as authority or anything like that. God is our authority, but that authority is only exercised for the sake of those under you. It's a purely generous, gracious act.
Thank you for a wonderful talk, Jerry. Super. Yep.
Go ahead. Just make sure everyone can hear.
Yeah.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. You shouldn't have ended up where you did. You're young, you're hip, you're American, and now you're lecturing on the beauty of classical theism. The 20th century was this lurch in a different direction. So I'm always curious, who said what? Bibliography, was there an essay you read where you fell in love with this classical vision rather than lurching in other directions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, just to be clear, I wouldn't, you know, I disagree with, but don't fault people that go other directions, absolutely. So I came to study in Scotland and was really wrestling with my faith and didn't know what I believed at all. Was very much open. And I, for the first year of my master's degree, was going all sorts of different directions. So I was definitely going in a much more modern direction, a much less classical direction than what I've just articulated here. And for me, interacting with John Webster was the main catalyst. And I think there's definitely a small generation of people similar to myself that realize that traditional isn't the same as backwards conservative, if that makes sense. And that's not an insult on being conservative or anything like that. But in my mind, I was rebelling against a sort of small anti-intellectual vision of faith and realizing that the traditional way that Calvin, Aquinas, Augustine, many of the greats of the church thought about God isn't that. It's actually a really robust, free, open, compelling vision of God. Does that make sense?
Yeah, wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jared. Thinking of it, particularly in terms of the theme of today, Christian identity, holiness, one of the ways we talk about God is totally other things to talk about his holiness. Mm-hmm. God is holy. It's not just another attribute. It's everything you've said. Mm-hmm. He's just totally inconceivably different to us. And yet the theme of today is that this God defined as the other, the holy, the separate, is the God who calls us to be holy through a gift of holiness. So there's the tension, isn't it? The holiness defines his otherness and yet speaks of his relatedness. Mm-hmm. Do you just want to comment?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Looking
yes. That's a really, really good question. And this is something that I'll be honest, I have a hard time articulating. And so I'll just say we don't have enough time to articulate it, which we don't. But also, I probably couldn't give it a good answer anyways. Okay, so we tend to have a contrastive account of the way God relates to the world. We tend to think that for God to do something in the world, a human or a creature needs to get out of the way, needs to move back. So, or for God to be magnified, humans need to be diminished. I just totally reject that way of thinking altogether. So God's holiness is actually his love of his own perfection. God affirms and loves what it is to be God. So holiness is no barrier whatsoever for him to be present amongst creatures. As Hosea talks about, he is the Holy One in our midst. So God's holiness is the fact that God loves and affirms himself, which is just what is good and which tends to flourishing and beauty and all of those things. And so that is not a hindrance for him to be in our presence. And so I do think that when that holiness expresses itself as judgment, that is God actually in the presence of creatures, saying the way that you're living and being diminishes your good and would is an attempt to diminish my good. And so that's why God's holiness sometimes expresses itself as judgment. But I just think God's holiness is his love of himself, and therefore his love of what is good and what is right and what leads to flourishing and beauty and all of those things. So it's no barrier at all for him to be present. And actually, if God wasn't completely, comprehensively present with all things, they would immediately cease to exist. So I think that God's holiness isn't a barrier to him being. Does that answer your question? But I know that's getting into a lot of issues. I'm really a big fan of Catherine Tanner on that stuff. She does really well, talks about how, particularly in the modern period, we started thinking about God and creation in contrastive ways, which we don't. I just don't think there's a reason to.
One more question, and then we'll bring Jamie in.
Thanks, Jared. I'm wondering about mystery and transcendence, certainty versus not being able to know. The exercise of the kind of puzzle of thing that you think is God, but you're sure it's not what God's like. How can the incarnation make God know he's so other, but actually humanity is actually the just version of God that corrupted?
What was the last bit you said? Humanity is a version of
God. Is the most human or the most perfect good guy in the world?
If God is the most perfect, if God is perfect and we're not, then I'm not completely getting the question, but so in terms of the, so I'll apologize for that. So I might be misunderstanding that, Jerome. Sorry, let's talk about that after. But in terms of is that Muslim, well, there's a lot to say about that. I mean, no, because the incarnation or the Trinity on a Muslim view is impossible. And the way they think about God's transcendence would deny the incarnation, and the part of the precise reason why Christians developed a particular way, a particular metaphysics, you could even say, was precisely to make sense of the incarnation. How could it be that this God that is so perfect can actually be utterly immediate to the things he has made? So it is a different vision. However, there is sometimes, I think, a problem in modern theology of being afraid of any possible similarity between Christianity and Islam. And in the history of the church, there were times when people like Thomas Aquinas learned from Islamic scholars. So I don't think that just because there's any similarity with Islam, that's necessarily a bad thing. But as I said, I think there's a radical difference, particularly in the sense that transcendence, God being totally unlike us, doesn't inhibit him from being totally intimate and with us.
Thank you.
Okay, great.